From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now, the mystery of Maiden Lane. That's the name the Federal Reserve gave to $75 billion of troubled financial products. It bought those products from Bear Stearns and AIG to save the companies from collapse. But in the nearly 2 years it's owned the package, the central bank has refused to say what exactly is in it. Until last week, when the Fed opened its Maiden Lane books. Hannah Jaffe-Walt with our Planet Money team took a look inside.
David Zervos is one of those guys who writes a report every time the central bank coughs. He's an equity strategist with Jefferies & Company, and usually his reports are pretty technical. Not the report on the Maiden Lane assets. It announced, to say this portfolio is a pile of junk is being unkind to junk.
It was just unbelievable. However, Wall Street decided to cut up and dice up and slice up all the risk on all these different loans. It's all there. It's disturbing.
What's all there? Loans to luxury hotels in Malaysia, Hawaii, Trinidad, the Orchard Hotel in Baton Rouge, the Civic Opera House in Chicago. Spring 2008, Bear Stearns was on the brink. J.P. Morgan was interested in taking over the company, but did not want these assets. So the Fed told J.P. Morgan, okay, you take Bear, we will take the toxic assets. And in that moment, the Fed went from being a boring, button-up shirt central bank to a bank that now receives mortgage payments every month from American homeowners and Hiltons in Hawaii and Malaysia. I talked to Vincent Reinhart with the American Enterprise Institute about this. Now, that's a strange position for the Fed to be in.
You know what gets even stranger? What would happen if one of those entities actually failed, that is, stopped making payments? The Federal Reserve could wind up owning a hotel in an airport or a hotel out, you know, overlooking a golf course.
As Reinhart says this, I point out that on page 24, it does look like there's one asset that has already failed, Crossroads Mall.
Yeah, it owns it. REO means real estate owned.
So the Fed owns that mall?
Yeah.
Thank you for calling the Crossroads Mall shopping line. If you know the name of the store you are interested in...
The Fed's mall has a Chick-fil-A, an AMC theater, and an annoying phone directory. This month, it is some guy's job to sell the mall for the Federal Reserve. Deeper into the pages of Maiden Lane, there are credit default swaps. Credit default swaps are basically a bet on the success of an investment. And the Fed has swaps on the state of California, Nevada. In one case, the Fed is in the unlikely position of betting against a Florida school district, meaning if the district can't make good on its debt, the Fed makes money.
Mind-bending, isn't it?
It is a little mind-bending.
So yeah. Actually, you should have the image of Chairman Ben Bernanke flying to a speaking engagement, and he could look out the window and look down and say, boy, I own a piece of that, I own a piece of that, I own a piece of that. And that's the way the Fed's balance sheet is right now.
Well, we're not happy about it. These were special circumstances.
This is not Ben Bernanke, but close, William Dudley. He's president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. We talked to him yesterday. And imagine you're him. You came into your job thinking, okay, central bank president, invest in one boring thing, U.S. Treasuries, not the wildest creations Wall Street ever dreamed up.
I did not expect, as president of the New York Federal Reserve, that I'd be having to worry about a mall in Oklahoma City.
The Fed didn't go into these investments blindly or without reason. Dudley says everyone truly believed that it would be financial Armageddon if they didn't step in. And the Fed's an independent entity. It can do what it wants. But there are two big reasons this all matters to us. Every week, the Federal Reserve hands over profits to the government. So gambling on toxic assets could mean less for us. Second, to buy up all this junk, the Fed essentially had to create money. Creating money often leads to inflation, bad for you and me. So far, neither of these things has happened. The biggest change has simply been one of identity, a transformation from a boring central bank to more of a regular bank. And actually, not just a regular bank, but a pretty risky one. I'm Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. It's springtime, and the crocuses are out and the daffodils are opening up. In good times, spring brings shoppers out, too. Well, a surprise increase in retail spending in March suggests that maybe after 2 years of penny pinching, American wallets are opening again, too. Here's NPR's Yuki Noguchi.
On a blindingly sunny day, Pamela Vestal emerges from an Urban Outfitters wearing big sunglasses with the sticker still on them.
Are those new glasses?
Yes.
What else did you buy in there?
A purse and a wallet and some shoes. About a few things.
How much did you spend?
About $100.
Is that something you wouldn't have done last year?
Yes, I definitely wouldn't have. Not that much, especially this bag, $48. No, I would have looked Walmart someplace else for something a lot cheaper.
Vestal's retail hiatus had spanned a year. She spent less on food and let her wardrobe get stale.
I just recently started shopping, buying stuff for spring. I didn't buy a lot during the winter.
But now she's even shopping for a house in the Washington, D.C. area. Consumer spending is more than a pastime. It drives nearly three-quarters of the U.S. economy, and it declined sharply during the recession. Manufacturers made less, retailers put less stuff on the shelves, and fewer workers on the floor. And economists have been waiting for the moment when that would reverse. With spending up, they're thinking, maybe this is that moment. Or maybe it's just the nicer weather.
March is usually a tricky month to read anyway.
Marshall Cohen is an analyst for the NPD Group. He says it's especially tricky to tell whether last month really marked a retail revival, because part of it is just pent-up need. People can only wear old clothes and use broken toasters so long before replacing them. Also, Cohen says Easter came early this year. Bunnies and pastel eggs triggered seasonal buying a little earlier. And after a harsh winter, warmer weather is getting people like Pamela Vestal out buying sunglasses.
A lot of frugal fatigue has set in, where the consumer's saying, I'm tired of not spending and living on a budget.
Like, enough about the recession. What about me? Sandy Kennedy has spent a year putting off indulgences, but just recently she had a spring fling with her credit card.
I'm a purse and shoe person, so I've had some fun this spring.
Kennedy is president of the Retail Industry Leaders Association, a trade group. She says sellers are starting to stock more, delayed store openings are getting back on track, and she's noting the return of lifestyle brands at places like Target and JCPenney that are boosting sales at both chains. But there are some things that won't come back. Kennedy says during the downturn, retailers made themselves leaner. They're using software to schedule employees for peak times. They're substituting text messages for paper coupons, and they're putting things in smaller, sleeker packages.
So it takes less space, less pallets, less transportation.
But Kennedy says paring down only gets you so far. She's waiting for jobs and paychecks to come back. Since losing his advertising job a year ago, David Muldoon has temped and cut way back. This week, he was depositing his last freelance check at a bank in Montclair, New Jersey.
I literally just got a job offer last week, so I don't think it'll probably have an effect on my spending habits for quite a while.
For now, he's buying a bottle of wine, because his wife also just got a job offer. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Downsizing has been happening everywhere, from corporate ledgers to family budgets. Well, reporter Jeff London has found two Broadway shows that have used downsizing to extend their runs.
It sucks to be me.
No, it sucks to be me.
It sucks to be me.
It sucks to be me.
Producer Kevin McCullum says it doesn't suck to be him. His show Avenue Q has found new life and new audiences off-Broadway.
How do you have a hit musical off-Broadway? You go to Broadway for 6 years, you win the Tony Award. It's how you have a hit off-Broadway.
Avenue Q, the intimate, satirical adult puppet show, closed after a Broadway run of over 2,500 performances last September. McCullum and his partners then made the surprising announcement that they were going to move the production a few blocks away to a 499-seat theater off-Broadway. It may be only a 5-minute walk from Avenue Q's old theater to its new home, but McCullum says the savings are tremendous, from theater rent to advertising to salaries to smaller stage crews. And he says the budget isn't hindered by some of Broadway's built-in union rules.
One of the things about our new theater is we don't have some of the Broadway work rules that says if you do work, you have to pay at least 4 hours for something that only takes 30 minutes.
These savings are so significant that McCullum thinks they can fuel another 5 years to Avenue Q's run. He estimates that his operating expenses have been cut by two-thirds, and in just 6 months, Avenue Q has shown a profit. That got some other producers talking, like Harriet Levy, whose four-actor stage version of Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps just finished a very successful two-year run on Broadway.
With the running costs being sliced in half, you really didn't have to do too much thinking to figure out, yes, we should do this.
So they've moved in next door to Avenue Q at New World Stages, a former movie multiplex in the Times Square area that's been converted into a small theater center. Both shows have been able to recycle their Broadway sets and costumes, but Levy says there's another advantage to seeing The 39 Steps in a smaller theater.
This new home of ours has a real intimacy, and it just plays beautifully. I mean, it really feels like you're right there.
I think I'll pop out to the buffet car. Finished. Fancy anything?
No, thank you.
No, thank you.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
And smaller theaters mean smaller ticket prices.
On Broadway, it was about $116, and our top ticket price is about $89.50. So there's a difference.
Gordon Cox, theater reporter for Variety, says until recently, shows like Avenue Q, which began life at the tiny Vineyard Theater off-Broadway, would have never moved to Broadway in the first place. Since upsizing shows for Broadway has been a trend, downsizing could become a trend as well.
Small, quirky shows that in past years would have seemed natural for off-Broadway, now that they're becoming more common on Broadway, this can open the door to them thinking about downsizing again.
Producer Kevin McCollum says audiences have rediscovered Avenue Q off-Broadway only because the show's brand was built by its long Broadway run and Tony Award wins.
If Avenue Q had stayed off-Broadway from the very beginning, we would have been closed by now.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This weekend, state lawmakers from around the country are in Washington, D.C. for a meeting of the National Conference of State Legislatures. We decided to check in on how two states are dealing with some big issues, budget deficits in a struggling economy, and what the new health care law means for the states. First, to talk about budget issues in Kansas, I'm joined in the studio by State Representative Sharon Schwartz. She's a Republican. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
How would you assess the budget situation in Kansas right now?
We are in, I would say, dire straits for the state of Kansas. And I don't believe that legislators or the public, either one, have really come to realization of the situation that we're in. This will be the fourth year in a row that we've seen our revenues decline. And that hasn't happened as long as I can remember.
What is Kansas in the state legislature doing about that?
Well, at this point in time, we're sort of at loggerheads. And ordinarily, at this time of the year, we've already passed the preliminary budget, and we have not passed a budget. On the House side, we have looked at many of our exemptions, and we have exemptions on tax on utilities. And the bill wasn't able to come out of committee simply because at a time when most people's utility bills continue to go up, there is little support from the general public to hike taxes there. And it's on the same side, well, we have public schools, K through 12, who are very resistant in making any more cuts to the schools. There have been cuts for funding to our local school systems. There's been cuts to higher education. In public safety, we've closed some correctional facilities. There's been cuts to social services.
It sounds to a certain extent you're between a rock and a hard place. There's not a lot of support for tax hikes, and then you get resistance when you propose cuts, but there are holes that need to be plugged.
At this point in time, the fact is that if it comes back to making some hard decisions, are we going to continue to be able to provide services for people that need meals delivered to their home and assistance in their homes, or do we want to continue to make cuts to our schools so that they are strapped? I think that when we come down to that balance, we're going to have to make some tough decisions. I don't think it's going to be easy for us to go back.
Kansas State Representative Sharon Schwartz, thanks so much for coming in.
You're very, very welcome.
Another issue looming for states is how they will be implementing the new health care law. The states have to put some provisions in place this year. Others don't come into effect until 2014. And the cost estimates for the states range from millions in savings to billions in extra costs. Speaker of the New Hampshire House of Representatives, Terry Norelli, is a Democrat, and she joins me in our studio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What is the New Hampshire legislature doing to get ready for the changes that are coming in the health care law?
Well, you know, this is all brand new, obviously, to everyone. And so we're still gathering information and trying to figure out the kinds of things that we need to do. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of responsibilities, I think, at state level in terms of health care.
Yeah. Do you think it's going to cost the state money or save the state money?
Over the long term, our Department of Health and Human Services has actually estimated a range. The worst case scenario, they figure, is about $8 million cost to the state. And the best case scenario is probably about $9 million in savings. And that's probably only about 1% of our Medicaid budget.
Wow. Well, the new health care law requires states to change the eligibility for Medicaid to 133% of the poverty level. In some states, that's going to mean a lot more people will be enrolled in the program. You know, how will your state pay for the medical care for all these additional people?
Oh, well, we're struggling with Medicaid costs, just as every other state, I think, is struggling with that, particularly in these very difficult economic times. But when we look at the question of the services that we provide now and the cost to the state for those services versus the services that we will be required to provide under federal health care reform and the additional cost for the ones that we are not currently providing and the additional assistance from the federal government for those services that we are providing, it comes out pretty much cost neutral in the long term.
The House of Representatives in New Hampshire has about 400 members. It's the largest state legislature in the country. And that means you have like one lawmaker for every 3,300 people. Given those numbers, it appears that the New Hampshire legislators have a closer relationship with their constituents than they do in many other states. What are the legislators hearing from people about the new health care law at this point?
Well, I think we are hearing a lot of good things and a lot of concern. In some regards, some of the very things that we've been looking at in New Hampshire in terms of trying to improve access and cost of healthcare services are beginning to be addressed in the national healthcare reform.
Do the Republicans agree with you in the legislature?
Oh, I'm sure that some do and some don't. I'm sure also that there are some Democrats that agree and some don't. We run the span from those who are upset that we don't have a single payer plan to those that think that the government doesn't have any business providing even one penny towards health care. So New Hampshire has that full range of perspectives, as I'm sure many other states do.
The reconciliation process must be a bear.
Well, with 400 members in New Hampshire, we have our own procedural challenges.
Terry Norelli is the Speaker of the New Hampshire House of Representatives. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.